Hi, I'm Jocelyn Beal.
Hi, I'm Charlie Yvonne Simpson.
Hi, I'm Nzinga Williams.
Hi, I'm Ebony Booth, and you are listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And obviously, this podcast is all about performing arts, and I know most of y'all are interested in performing arts, but I do know there's at least a few visual artists out there who listen in, which I think is great. As artists, we have to be well-rounded. It's important for us to take in all disciplines, whether it's performance, visual, film, writing, or beyond, to keep us open and inspired in our work. Which brings me to the recommended event of the week. The Art Expo 2020 is happening this April in New York City, and it basically sounds like Broadway Con, but for the art world. Each year, thousands of art industry insiders flock to Art Expo New York in search of the art and artists that will shape trends and galleries worldwide. But as y'all know, that is just the beginning with Gold Star. They provide affordable ticket options to theater, comedy shows, concerts, and so much more. So download Gold Star and let's make some memories, y'all. And I know every week I'm like, I'm so hyped, I'm so thrilled, I'm so excited. And that is true, and that will continue to be true because we have some amazing artists right now, and I'm so grateful to be experiencing their work. I got to experience this guest's off-Broadway playwriting debut this weekend, and there were so many things that caught my attention, one being the horoscope references, which we will get into. But as an actor, you may have seen her in After the Blast at Lincoln Center Theater, Fulfillment Center at Manhattan Theater Club, Dance Nation, Playwrights Horizon. I'm like, can I memorize all of the acronyms I have is what I'm testing myself on right now. Revolt, she said, Revolt again at Soho Rep. The Cider House Rules at Atlantic.
At Atlantic.
Like, I mean, she is...
And that was in 1999.
But was that your off-Broadway debut?
That was my off-Broadway debut. That's how I got my equity card.
So, like, how cosmic and full circle is all this? Y'all, give it up for Ebony Booth. Hey! Hi. Thank you so much for being here
Felicia,
today.
Felicia, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having
me. Too. You got good energy. What is your sign?
Oh, I'm a Libra. I'm a
Libra.
With a Cancer rising.
Okay.
And an Aries moon.
Okay. No, I like this. My roommate's a Libra and my mom's an Aries, both sun signs for them. Mm-hmm. And then I think Cancer, just because they're opposite me, you're like a very calming presence.
Yeah, it can happen. It can happen sometimes.
You know? So I'm so excited to talk all about your artistic journey today. I want to know, too, because I saw that you're from the Bronx.
I am. I'm from the beautiful Bronx.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Shout out. how did you get involved in performing arts?
I probably actually got involved for the first time up in the Bronx. I was actually thinking about this before coming here. I was around 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. My mother saw a notice in, like, I don't know, the Bronx news, some like daily or weekly newspaper we got.
Yeah.
Someone at Lehman College was holding auditions for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and they were looking for like actual young people to play some of the younger characters.
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of the book, so we went to Lehman College. I auditioned and I got the part of Charlie.
Wow.
Actually at the time, and it so that was really fun, and that was my first experience doing like sort of an actual play. There were adults involved.
Yeah.
And they were doing, there were some college students doing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream next door.
Okay.
So like, you know, we were kind of like in rep, if you will.
Right. At such a young age, we'd love to see it.
At such a young age. And so, and that was my first sort of glimpse of, a life in the arts. I don't even know how old these people were. To me, they felt like,
I
was like, they're 60. They were probably like 19. But a few of them like lived in the Village, and so like I would go watch their show, and then like go downtown with them, and be like, well, this could be something really fun and exciting.
Okay, because I was curious. I was wondering if you came down to the theater district to see any shows, but you went downtown.
I mean, I saw some shows like, you know, with like family and stuff on Broadway.
Yeah,
but I probably maybe the following year or something. You know, I told my parents that it was something I was interested in.
Yeah.
Someone, a friend of the family, got me like a copy of Backstage. Mm-hmm. And the Living Theater, which at that time was on 3rd Street between, I don't know, Avenue C and Avenue D. And this would have been like 1990.
Yeah.
They were holding open calls and I got cast as like little kitty number 2.
Right.
And my parents were like, great, we can't wait to commute from the Bronx down to Alphabet City. 6 times a week.
Yeah, no,
but
kidding,
I got this little part in this show, and it was, the bug. It was a lot of fun.
It bit you. Can't deny it. Who were some of the artistic influences and inspirations you were looking up to as you dipped your toe in theater?
It's funny because most of my as a kid, I mean, we grew up in New York, and I imagine I did see plays. Now, of course, I'm not remembering going to them a lot, but I watched a lot of movies.
Okay.
And, you know, we watched a lot of musicals, but there were some movies, I don't know if you were, I'm sure you were like this too, there were some movies I watched on repeat, like School Days, and some of those, like, musical sequences in School Days, I just wore that videotape out. I just wore the tape out, you know, and then there was, like, the usual set, you know, we watched The Color Purple ad nauseum, so all of these things with, like, really high stakes and really beautiful acting and really sort of memorable performances sort of figured really prominently in my imagination as I was growing up. And I was a big reader, so I read a lot, too, and I feel like that had a lot to do with my wanting to be in different worlds.
Did you have a book when you were younger that, like, specifically spoke to you?
Gosh, I mean, there were so many. I mean, I read a lot of Judy Blume. Sweet Valley High. I read a lot of Christopher Pike. Who was like, you know, suburban kids in trouble. Like, who shot Darcy at the mall? But I also read, I remember being young because my mom yelled at me for reading it and took it away. I read Terry McMillan's Mama, which I don't know where it falls. Like, I think it may have been right before Waiting to Exhale. It was like the book before or after Waiting to Exhale. But Mama was a book that I read that really resonated with me and made me think a lot about sort of like epic storytelling that extends beyond where you just see the evidence of lives lived. And, you know, it was about like family and sex and drinking and men who don't treat you well. You know, it was like all this stuff, but it just, my mind just sort of took off.
Yeah. You were like fueling your imagination at a young age.
Yeah.
Honestly.
My mother was like, what the hell? How'd you get this?
You're like, well, let me learn about life, Mom.
It's like, let me be free.
That's so funny. So when did, I mean, it does not surprise me that you're a reader, especially now that you are a playwright. Like, how did the playwriting identity start to intersect with your acting?
That's much, much more recent. What year are we in?
So 2020, about, I think. I'm not sure anymore.
A few years ago, like about 6 years ago, I was working on a show with Collaboration Town, which was a theater company of people I really, really love, and Boo Killebrew, who's a writer and an actor, who I'd met a few years before working on a play, Club Thumb. Boo sort of took me out for a drink, and Boo was doing more and more playwriting, and she was about to start making her way into the world of television writing. And she said to me, she was like, you know, you should think about writing. You read a lot. You know, it might just be something else. And I was starting to be increasingly surrounded by actors who were trying to find other ways to be creative and get a little bit of autonomy. It's so hard, you know, I mean, it can be just so hard sitting around waiting for someone to give you an opportunity.
Yeah.
And Boo was really encouraging. And I wrote a play that was okay. It was okay. It wasn't setting anything on fire. It didn't really make much sense, but I was like, hey, it's 60 pages of something.
That's impressive.
It's not bad,
yeah,
right?
No, I think that's great.
Exactly. And before that, I had taken some playwriting classes, but nothing could stick. I could not finish a play. I could not finish a play for my life. So after Boo's encouragement, I finally finished a play. And then I wrote another play, which was like marginally better, but still not great. Not great. Like, a lot of it should have just been fed to the trash can, but I like sent it out. I did that thing you do. I saw all my friends doing it. I was like, oh, I'll apply to the O'Neill. I just like sent it to all those writers groups, and I applied to Juilliard, you know, like, and everyone was like, we're good, thank you. Thanks, you know, we don't want that play. But that sort of coincided, all of that rejection sort of coincided with me doing a little more acting work.
Okay.
So I got quite busy. I was so lucky and I got kind of busy acting. And the amazing thing about doing new plays and working in new play development is that you really start to learn how plays get put together.
Sure.
So I did about like 6 shows back to back. And over the course of that 2 years, I started to realize that what I was finding myself increasingly intrigued by were questions of story and world building. And, you know, we would be in workshops and I'd be offering lots of opinions and people were like, cool, this is my play. Why don't you write your own play? And I was like, well, what if the uncle comes back? You know, so it was, I just found myself a little tempted. And so I decided I would try to write another play. And I was a little scared because I was like, yikes, I don't really know how to do it. So I took a short story that I had liked and adapted it into a play. And I was like, I'll just apply to school and see, and yeah. I was lucky, and I got in, and I'm so grateful.
Wow. So I'm curious, because I even just like hearing you talk now, I feel like your mind moves a mile a minute in the sense of like creating a story, like you said, building mm-hmm. a world. So what initially attracted you to theater in the professional realm? Like, talk us through those first couple of professional shows.
Well, it's a little tricky, you know. So I excuse me, when I went to LaGuardia High School, I went to the High School of Performing Arts. Okay. And I got a job a few months after I graduated at the Atlantic, right? I was like, yes. cast in the Cider House Rules. I was 18. I was about to turn 19. I like had my little equity card. I was working with all these people. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the life. And then the show closed and I just couldn't get arrested. And I was like, not a good auditioner. I was really insecure. I was like, kind of okay at acting. Like, I was okay. You know, like, yeah. I had some potential, but I didn't know what to do with it. I was really green. I would go into auditions and mess them up all the time. And I spent 3 years. I hadn't gone to college. So I spent 3 years sort of just, like, wandering around being like, oh, gosh, what the heck am I doing? Decided to go to college. Decided not to pursue acting. Went to college in Vermont. And then at the end of my stint in Vermont, I had a suspicion that I would be a little haunted if I didn't give it a try. So I came back to New York, and I spent 5 or 6 years just not knowing what the heck I was doing. I would go to open call. I let my equity membership lapse, so I was non-equity. Mm-hmm. I was waking up at like 5:30 in the morning.
It's not easy.
Signing up for like non-equity unofficial lists. It's humbling. It's, you know, you feel like dirt. You're just like, what the heck am I doing with my life? I was waiting tables. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky because I found a place that, you know, I made money and I had friends, but I was like drinking a lot and just a little aimless. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And again, I couldn't crack it. I couldn't find work that was compelling to me. I had no sense of myself really as an actor. Mm. I just knew I wanted to work. I didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. And then I was lucky, like little by little by little, things started to sort of click together. I was a bat at the Flea for a year.
And then
I like did a show with Club Thumb, and they're so community oriented. So I met a lot of people through them. I met the folks at Collaboration Town. And then, you know, I got into the world of doing like readings and workshops. And of course, the benefit of that is that you're acting all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're acting all the time. It's a different kind of pressure. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that really changed things for me, and I will credit them always for really helping me, is that some folks in the casting department at Lincoln Center, Daniel Swee and Camille Hickman, started employing me as an audition reader.
Oh.
So I started being, you know, you would come into audition and I'd be that person who's like, okay, I'll read Tommy, you know, with you. And
yeah.
I did audition reading for about a year and a half, and I was like a stage directions reader for like workshops and stuff. So all these people who I would, you know, be lucky enough to encounter later in life, I was there like, you know, just reading in their auditions. And what it really helped with was demystifying the audition process. And I started to understand a little more about how actors help themselves and sometimes how they get in their own way. I found a really, really good acting teacher who helped me feel tethered by the work as opposed to just being totally just sort of scrambling and left to my nerves to figure it out. You know, I was able to find a concentration and a focus in a way I couldn't have done before.
Yeah.
So like the confluence of all those things and the timing of it all happening at the same, around the same time sort of led me to getting what was sort of the first job, Revolt. I worked on Revolt at Soho Rep, and Liliana cast me, and from there I was able to things started sort of clicking into place. But again, that's pretty recent. I mean, that was in 2015.
Right.
Excuse me, 16. Mm-hmm. So it was just like season, 4 years ago. Just before that I was like bartending and being grumpy and being like, screw this life. What the heck am I doing?
Well, it's hard though. I mean, it is.
It's hard.
I think the theater is, it requires so much endurance and persistence. Yeah, you're like,
It does. And I think when you, I mean, I certainly reached this point, you know, I was just like, gosh, I've been doing this so long. I'm such a dope. I'm such a failure. I'm just like, you know, I couldn't, it was hard not to really feel bested by my insecurities and, you know, feeling like I should have been doing this by this age. I was obsessed with like looking at people's IMDb pages and being like, how old were they when they made
comparison.
It? How do they comparison? I remember being on Playbill.com and being like, okay, who's doing what? You know, I was just so obsessed with other people. And again, like I had no sense of real work. I just knew that there was all this stuff out there that I thought I wanted that I wasn't getting. And so, you know, that kind of thinking, it just leaves you, it leaves you unhappy, yeah. You know, and you feel like you're just, all you can feel is the lack.
Right,
and then I feel
right.
like when I got really specific about what I wanted, I just started finding people who were able to put me in touch with that more,
yeah.
you know, if that makes sense.
Totally. I'm curious, too.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the experience like of applying? And I just want to know what Juilliard's like, really, essentially. Like,
yeah.
As an institution as well.
I'd applied once and didn't get in. And Adam Simkowitz, who runs... who works in the office over there, sent me an email saying, like, apply again. And I'm glad he did, because I waited about 2 years. And then I applied again. And I was so lucky, and I got in. And it was, you know, it's challenging. It's great. We have to write 3 plays a year.
All right.
That ain't no joke. That ain't no joke.
Right.
We're writing 3 plays a year. And you're so nervous. You know, you feel like you want to... it's such a rigorous environment, you know, and you want to do the best work that you can. And I felt like I didn't know how I worked. I didn't really know. I had written like some plays, but I didn't have a body of work. And I still wasn't sure, like, how do I write a play?
Yeah.
I had just, like, squirted some out. I was like, I think that's how, but I didn't really know.
Right.
And girl, that first play I took in, everyone was like, you know, they deny it now, but everyone was like, what on earth is this? And it shocked me to my core. I mean, I was like, I remember leaving that class. I was crying on the street. I like bought a pack of cigarettes. I was like, this is the worst. I don't belong here. I'm shoot, I made the wrong choice. But what was great about it, the play didn't make any sense. It was really boring. It was just all over the place. But what was great about it was I was like, F you all. I'm writing something else. okay. Y'all didn't like that? Okay. It was like kind of motivating.
Right.
You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like those scenes in those sports movies where like, you know, like the hot shot shows up and then like totally gets like knocked down by the coach who's like, you don't know anything.
Yeah.
And then he or she has to come back and like, you know, sort of prove.
Well, I think
his
like
or her
Elwood's in Legally Blonde or something where she's like, I'll show you how valuable Elwood's can be.
So I had to channel Elwood's. Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, all right, how do I write a play that's not boring and makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that was Paris, actually. Paris was the second play I took to school.
Wow.
And it was a mess initially, but there was something there, and I realized what I could really learn from my peers and my teachers.
And maybe that's a mix of the Aries moon and everything and the Cancer rising, because I just think that's really powerful and moving that you were able to take that moment of crying and being like, what the fuck? And be like, you know what? No, like, I'm going to go back and try it again. And that's the persistence and the endurance of the theater industry, I think.
Felicia, it really is. I also think it's a benefit. I mean, I don't know how it is for other people. For me, it's age, you know, and experience. I think if I had gone when I was in my mid-20s, I think I really would have... I mean, I don't know. But I think it would have been harder. I think I would have choked a little more. I think I would have been too... concerned and obsessed with what other people were doing, what other people thought of me.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
The
like, I don't know that I would have had that gumption to be like,
yeah,
screw you. I need to, I'm gonna show you, but I need to do it for myself. You know, like, I just
Absolutely.
Think that sort of internal monologue has something to do with maturation. But also, I mean, like, as you've said, the industry will beat your ass down.
It so sure will.
You can't
Chew
take
you
it.
You
know, so,
spit you out.
So luckily I've been rejected so many times as an actor that I was like, I know this feeling, and I know I can either just kind of feel sorry for myself, or I can figure out if there's some information here that could be useful to me.
Right.
You know, and I feel lucky that I could capitalize on that.
So you went back to the keyboard and typed out the script for Paris, which is why we're here today. I mean, we are here because of you, but because I saw the play. So you said you went to school in Vermont. Is that what inspired the setting?
I mean, ostensibly, yes. I went to college at the University of Vermont, and when I was up there, I did not work at a store. I worked at bars in town. I was in Burlington, which is, you know, a city by Vermont standards, you know, and there are a couple schools up there, but I worked at bars, and I worked at bars that attracted lots of different kinds of clientele.
Uh-huh.
And my time in Vermont was actually really wonderful. It's probably some of the best 4 years I had in my life. But it figures prominently. You know, there are some people I met, there are some characters I met. In some ways, parts of this play are a love letter to the time I spent up there.
So for the listeners, before you go buy your tickets, a quick summary is that it's about a town named Paris in Vermont and a black woman named Emmy who starts working at Barry's, which is like a Walmart.
It's like a Walmart, yeah.
And the community that's at that store, honestly. I feel like very nervous explaining this in front of you. So this is, I guess, my interpretation of it.
But please, like, please.
You know, seeing the how class and race intersect and how they dissect and they, you know, verge from each other as well. Being one of few people of color, black people, you know, a marginalized community within a larger group is a very specific experience.
It's a very specific experience.
And watching it, because I'd read you were from the Bronx, I was like, how does she, must have spent time like this. You know, did you have similar feelings like Emmy and Gar did?
Well, you know, I said it in Vermont, and I have spent a lot of time in Vermont, but Vermont in this case is a bit of a, almost like a structural stand-in for a condition I've experienced. I mean, I've experienced in New York City, you know, that feeling of, or just in other places. But I think that I have spent a fair amount of time in a lot of mostly white environments. I went to a sleepaway camp in New Jersey when I was a kid for 10 years. It was mixed, but it was predominantly white. Mm-hmm. School, you know, a lot of professional environments. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of borrowing something based on my experience, but I think that it's gesturing to something a little larger that can be found in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And you know, I my family's from New York, but also from Massachusetts. So the Northeast, New England sort of sits kind of large in my imagination. The weather, you know, if you get really far north in Vermont, parts of Maine, it's so cold. Mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for that when I went up there. It is really, really white. When I was up in Vermont, University of Vermont is where I went, and the student of color population was 1%, and the black population was 0.4%. And, I mean, lucky for me, because, one, it was the only school I got into. And they were like, girl, we'll pay for you. So I was like, woohoo!
So, you know, Vermont we go. Yeah.
I was like, that sounds good. And they were, I'd never even been to Vermont, you know. Yeah. And they were, like, trying to diversify. And I wound up having quite a wonderful experience up there. But it's you know, high visibility. I was bartending, so people knew who I was. And there were not many black people up there. And there was also a lot of poverty, you know, and I was in Burlington, which is a college town. And one thing that gets distorted in a lot of college towns, there are so many cute coffee shops and bookstores and, you know, like bars. But there's, you know, just on the margins of that are people who don't have access to a ton. And they're sort of crunched up against people who are just there temporarily. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing I've learned about myself in my writing is that I'm always sort of interested in writing about a certain kind of loneliness and isolation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write about a loneliness that was racial and that was economic. And I know that there have been the times in my life when I've just felt the most down and out. I've just felt so, invisible. Mm-hmm. And that gets exacerbated in places like that. And then if I've had, you know, I don't know, no money, if I feel like I can't take care of myself, it's, you know, it all just sort of starts to crunch together. And to the extent that I'm trying to write about things that I might want to see myself or experiences that feel like they might speak to certain aspects of myself, I felt like, oh, well, you know, I know something about this. I certainly know something about being broke. You know, I still obsessive. I mean, I check my bank balance like 4 times a day still. Yeah. That will never leave me, you know, just because just the anxiety of like, oh, shoot, how am I going to pay for this? How am I going to make this work? How am I going to make this work? And so, you know, then I started to try to be creative about what could be an interesting place to put some of these concerns.
Yeah.
You know, and explore some things. And in talking to some people, you know, at first I was like, oh, gosh, is this going to resonate? Is it going to, who's the audience for this? And then, you know, I'm talking to some people and talking to a lot of black people who've spent time in, maybe not specifically this environment, but who understand something of being the only one. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, maybe you know, maybe this will resonate in a certain way.
Do you remember the first scene you wrote for it?
Yeah, the first scene I wrote was the first scene of the play. Oh, so again, okay. I'm kind of basic and still figuring this stuff out. So I'm like, at the beginning. I marvel at people who are like, I started with the end right. And then worked my way back. Girl, no, I started at the beginning.
Very good place to start.
And I will say, like, because we have to do so much writing at Juilliard, I was like, oh, shoot, I got to write another play. I went to a list of screenplay ideas I'd had.
Oh.
So I was like, and I had this idea about this. I mean, it was like a crime caper, like this woman at this store, she kills her boss.
Ooh.
She like gets another woman to help cover it up. It's like this whole thing. And I was
right.
like, so that's not gonna be a play. Although in the first draft of Paris, there was a murder and everyone was like, what the heck is it? Yeah, it was like, everyone was like, what's happening here? But so I had this idea. So again, it's just like some of my like creative concerns match with like the need to crank out another play.
Sure.
And I was like, let's see what happens if I marry these two things together.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, it totally makes sense. I just wasn't sure if there was a specific, you know, like instance that inspired you. Like, I gotta write this first. But it's I was fascinated too, and I think this definitely says a lot about my assumptions and perhaps the industry and the relationship to Black theater these days. But I texted the PR rep saying, are there any gunshots in the show? One, because I just don't like gunshots in shows. She said, no, you're fine. So I get to the theater, and there's a warning that there's herbal cigarettes and loud noises. I'm like, did the PR girl lie
to
me? Are there gunshots? My first instinct went to, oh my gosh, like, I knew it was about a Black woman. Like, the Black woman's going to get hurt. Like, something's going to happen to her.
Yeah.
Because I think we do see a lot of, like, Black pain,
heck
especially
yeah.
to Black women
yeah.
on stage these days. I'm not going to give a spoiler alert for the listeners because you just have to go see it. But it's not like it's not that. I say this to say that something I found surprising because of what we see so much lately is that it was a very nuanced conversation about race.
Mm.
And that goes back to the invisibility thing. Like, I just and this expectation I apparently have to see Black death or pain or something on stage.
Yeah.
But so I guess I was just curious about
I mean, Felicia, that makes sense. And that's certainly in my mind a lot. And, you know, it's in my mind when I'm thinking about, I mean, look, everybody's got to tell their story, whatever, however they're telling it. And I'm here for that and want to be supportive as I can. But there are certain ways, you know, I try, you know, I'm realizing that I'm sort of interested in maybe posing more questions and answering them. In finding like the mystery and finding the things that are unspoken and maybe a little more implied than explicit. And so one thing I've tried to keep an eye on as Jules, who plays Emmy, and I have been sort of working together and as we're all piecing the piece together is not wanting her to be a victim and not wanting her to just be, you know, sort of sieged by these outside circumstances outside of her control. But I do want to give voice to the to her plight and to this circumstance that I've put her in. But no, it might not quite look. I think that the moments of danger that she finds herself in might not seem as. This sounds like I'm like, well, you've never seen anything like this before. That's not what I'm saying at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. But you know, hopefully, maybe it's like a slightly different take on. On us in peril, because I want to be careful about women in pain. You know, I don't need to
absolutely.
See any more TV shows where women are like stuffed in a bag, stuffed in a dumpster, thrown down the stairs.
Yes.
You know, and she has stuff to contend with. You know, I mean, there's stuff that happens, but I kind of wanted to be thoughtful and mindful about what happens and how she contends with it and how it sort of maybe can crunch up against some of our assumptions.
Absolutely. And like you just mentioned, there was definitely, I actually wrote this down on my notes, like there was an ever present sense of danger.
Yeah.
Even though it was set at a Barry's like superstore.
It's set at a store, and now some of that is my taste. Some of it is the stories that I like to read. You know, I read a lot of Stephen King when I was growing up.
Okay.
I read a lot of those R.L. Stein, a lot of crime. I love Walter Mosley. Like, I read a lot of stuff that deals with, like, dread and shadows and secrets and what happens when those secrets come out. So I know that does inform some of what I find myself creating now. And I also think there is a part of me that, you know, Emmy doesn't have much family. I don't know how your mom is or how your parents are. I grew up with a mom who was always scared. I was one of four girls. And there was always the ever-present fear of, like, what's going to happen? Don't do this. Don't do that. We would leave. She'd be like, don't get raped. You know, like, she's, my mother still does it. I'm like, hey, mom. She's like, what time did you get home? You can't be walking those streets. People are crazy. They just ready to grab you. Like, that's just my mom, and that's how I grew up.
Yeah.
But I think that fear that a lot of mothers, period, and certainly a lot of Black mothers have, and this goes back to some of what you were saying about wanting to develop this podcast at all, that that the world isn't safe for our children. That is something that I find myself wanting to deal with. And I'm curious about who's looking out for Emmy and how she's got to look out for herself. And, you know, the exhaustion of that and the fatigue of finding a safe place. You know, one thing I do, my boyfriend is white, and he and I have been going to Maine a few times for the past few summers. And this last time we went to like an antique fair. And it's just that thing you do, you know, where you go into a place where you don't know anybody and you're the only one, and you just do a like, you just do a scan of like, is this person friendly? Is this person going to say hello? Why won't that guy say hello to me? What is it? You know, it's just though, it's just that constant monitoring and analyzing. And that is, you know, that's quite exhausting. And it's just like, it's just a state I've kind of become used to living in. But I think it's also like a state of alertness and readiness.
Totally.
And so I don't know. So that some of that stuff interested me, and being able, of course, when you're like that, you see more. You're like a bit more of an observer, and you have a different sense of the lay of the land.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I don't want to reveal too much, so we can talk about it later. But I mean, I do think, especially we see Emmy kind of have. When she's being introduced to the characters, this feels like a non-spoiler way to say it, I feel like we see her coming up against meeting a new character, a potential conflict, and then it kind of like,
yeah,
you know, there's a sink back. But she doesn't ever, to me, she didn't seem like she could fully, I don't even know if I want to say the word relax, but just take a beat until the very last scene.
Until the very last scene. And that was deliberate. And, you know, and when I remember the first rehearsal where we started clicking into that, and Jules, the actress, was like, oh, yuck. This feels, I mean, my words, but she was like, oh man, this feels crappy. And I was like, I know. And I think that I wrote that, I hope, I don't know that it's on the page, but I was like, hey, director, make it so, you know, I tried to make something that felt sort of tense and coiled without being unpleasant. You know, I'm not that good with stuff that's just like has you in a tight knot the whole time, but I wanted to convey that the stakes are really high for her for a number of reasons. Some financial, some emotional, and some cultural and racial. Yeah. And so, and yeah, we don't get to see her breathe.
Yeah,
very
that's
often,
it.
Right?
She doesn't get to breathe.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful way of saying it. Oh, he's such a writer.
Meep.
Look at you, the words. So I do want to hear, though, what was your experience engaging with theater as a playwright?
Yeah.
You know, how did the actor side inform the playwright in the rehearsal room? Tell me everything.
Yeah, it's been still kind of new. I mean, this is my first. I've done two workshop readings before this. And then Neil Pepe at the Atlantic was like, come on, girl.
Yes.
You've been hanging around long enough. Let's do this.
Oh,
so that's
gosh,
been so wonderful.
I love it.
But, you know, Knute Adams, who's the director I've been working with and is the only director I've really worked with, with exception one or two instances as a writer. And he and I have developed a really wonderful relationship and a really great shorthand. And I know him as an actress first, but there's so much trust there and a real overlap of sensibility.
Good.
You know, I'm opinionated and
Aries moon, y'all.
It's hard to, you know, and I have a lot to say. So sometimes it's hard. He's so lovely. He's very patient. Sometimes it's hard to not chime in and pipe in all the time. But one thing I do understand as an actor is like, you know, their process is so different than mine. And you and I talked about this a little bit before. You know, as a writer, you come to it and the writing, for the most part, we did a lot of revisions through rehearsal, but the writing is sort of behind you. Everyone else is coming to it brand new.
Right.
And I think that, you know, my insecurity and my fear and my shame is like, it's making me urge to like, get it right, nail it, don't do it bad, learn the lines, you know, like I'm so frantic.
Right.
But really everyone else needs their process and their own timeline to sort of come to it. So So it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. And I have some sense of what I've responded to as an actor. And I think that's been helpful. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Talk to the cast and let them be like, she was the worst. Capital W.
No. I feel like it could only benefit. I really do.
I hope so. I hope so again. You know, I'm not so obnoxious that I'm getting up there and being like, let me show you how I would do it. Mm-hmm. You know, but I spend a lot of time thinking about work and about what I want to convey. And Knut is more thoughtful than I am. And so the two of us together are, and I've realized that we're like a little relentless and I, for better or for worse. But you know, I think that there's a certain kind of way I want to work and a certain pursuit of truth and simplicity and empathy and compassion that feels important to me. And when we're all working in that way, regardless of the outcome, you just feel it and it makes you feel alive. Yeah. You know, it really, really does. That's been thrilling. And it's a feeling I've had as an actor, certainly not as often as, you know, it's hard. You never know what you're going to get going into different rooms and different projects. But I've had it enough to know to chase it.
Yeah.
You know, to chase the people who you want to work with, who want to work in a loving but rigorous, thoughtful and open way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what has been maybe the biggest learning moment for you as a playwright or as an actor during this process?
Yeah, it's hard watching your plays. I had some writers who have warned me, but when you're sitting in the back of that theater and you're like, what on earth did I do? Why did I invite people look at this? I'm so embarrassed. It's humiliating. I mean, it's great when it works. It's exposing. You feel very, very exposed. And I had really underestimated that. And because as an actor, you get to take the ride of the play. Mm-hmm. So that energy goes somewhere. You know, writer, you're just in that back row squirming and fidgeting and drinking a can of wine like I am. But, you know, you're just sort of like left to your own devices to just, I feel a little constipated at the end of it. You have to find a different way to release. Uh-huh. And I have to be careful not to let my anxiety about that exposure. You know, I don't want to put that on anybody else. I don't want to put that on the actors. I don't want to put that on the director.
Yeah.
You know, but when you feel bad, you just want to do everything you can to feel better.
Right. No matter
but
what
sometimes,
it takes.
No matter, right. But sometimes you just have to sit in that discomfort. And this has been a big lesson about, you know, this is the ride. This is the process. This is the work. And it feels great when it resonates. It feels crappy when it doesn't. But it's, you know, putting this stuff out there has taken some getting used to. And it's still new. You know, we're only a week in.
It's the growth. Yeah.
Girl, talk to me in 3 weeks when I'm like, you know, hanging off the side of a building drunk. Naked.
I love it. I love it. Realistic. No, it's true. The last couple of questions I have, I'm just here for more like black female playwright voices.
Yeah.
Just as a general concept.
Yeah.
So this is a loaded question that I don't think we can answer tonight in this room, but what is advice for aspiring playwrights or how can we make more of that happen?
That's a good question.
It's
a big question, and we're in such a tricky time now because, you know, we do see, I mean, there's a lot more attempts. I don't want to say that like they're empty. Of course they're not. You know, there's a lot of a lot of attempts to sort of diversify, and sometimes you get the feeling that it's an actual genuine attempt, you know, and sometimes you get the feeling like, oh, this is about optics or people want to be on the right side of history. And part of me is like, well, you know, if it opens a door, you know, that feels kind of paramount. And then, you know, you look at cases, you look at someone like, I don't know, look at Jocelyn Bio, you know, Mean Girls at MCC and like, you know, not to cast aspersions, but MCC hadn't done,
it was in 20 years.
Right, they hadn't done a playwright of color. Certainly not. I can't speak intelligently about what the facts were, but I hadn't seen anything like that. And then, you know, I went to see Schoolgirls twice. I took my family. And I was just like, and then it's really sort of, it feels like it's shaking something up over there. And I don't know. I don't know what that means, but I think that it's what's nice is when you look at the range of writers who they programmed since, it's there's still diversity, even though they are like a lot of black female writers. All of them have distinct stories. All of them have distinct voices. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the goal, right? That, you know, we're not a monolith. Mm-mm. That people have lots of different ways of expressing different things. And hopefully people need to start making space for that. And we should really be calling into question the things that we're just sort of comfortable seeing over and over again. And so
I like that.
Yeah. I want to be, you know, again, I try to interrogate myself like, oh, shoot, like, why did you make a play with so many white people? You know, like so many white people, just like sort of having those conversations about what we're up to. And it's hard. Those questions can be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That's going down another. Felicia, let's talk about that. But we can talk about that.
We'll have podcast part two.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be podcast part two. But I think that, you know, trying to make space for a real multitude, for an abundance, you know, that feels informed, not just by what we think subscribers want to see, but, you know, what could we all benefit from? And a diversity in terms of, you know, we want it in terms of form. We want it in terms of content. We want it in terms of not just, yeah, maybe I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
No, I like that. I like that. Maybe you should start a podcast. I'll listen to it.
Competition.
I
love
what you got to say. No, I would support. I love that you brought up Schoolgirls too, because I loved that play so much.
Yeah, I did too. I'll never stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
I'll never stop thinking about it because, I mean, for a number of reasons, I just feel like Jocelyn tackled that. Now I sound like copy, but, you know, Jocelyn, you know, in her way, in her distinct way, which is full of comedy, which is full of pathos, which is full of feeling, you know, being someone who was a young girl, you know, just, you know, dealing with issues of like colorism and class and who's on the inside, who's not on the inside, and national identity, and, you know, not having and having the being able to present a version of life for adolescent girls in Ghana that's not just about their, you know, the pain is different. It's not what the New York, it's not what the newspapers are telling us, you know? And some people, and I guess this when we have diversity, some people don't want to see that. They're just like, they want to define black people, black experiences, black stories in like sort of very narrow terms. And it's been really good to see people who've been able to push past that.
Yeah. I include you in that too.
Well, yeah, and I couldn't have done it. I mean, Jocelyn's also been, you know, personally, I've known her for years, just sort of knocking around both of us black, you know. Yeah. But then we became friends a few years ago, and she's been so inspiring and so encouraging, and you know, she similarly sort of like hustled coming up that acting ladder. But to see her write the things that she wants to write, that her voice so clearly, that she can do in a way that just no one else can. I mean, that's just so thrilling.
Yeah.
It's so thrilling, and it's so proud. It's like you're saying, like, just being able to take my, I took my mom and my sisters to see it, and we were like screaming and laughing. It's just so, I'm like, oh, this is it.
Yeah.
This is what you work so hard to get.
Right.
Right.
This is it gonna get right.
This is actually it.
This
that
is
it's
it
not, you're like, oh man, it's like fancy clothes. It's a red carpet. No, it's just being in a theater, watching your friends play, feeling good, feeling seen, feeling like part of something with other people, laughing and taking part of it. That's what it can give you, I think.
Totally. You know? You've segued perfectly to the final two questions, because the first one is, if you could recommend a piece of black art, what would it be? Whether it's a theater piece or a book, album, musical album.
Can I do... So there's this podcast... not to bring up your competition, but there's a podcast called Long Form, and I think it's like by the University of Pittsburgh or something, but these guys do interviews with... I think mostly nonfiction writers, a lot of journalists, but a lot of the people have also started writing books. But I've been listening to the podcast recently, and there are three interviews that I just have been listening to on repeat with Ta-Nehisi Coates, Kiese Layman, and Carville Wallace. All three guys who I think at some point have worked in, you know, long form nonfiction prose, all have books out, and they have these like hour long interviews similar to what you're doing, about craft and about how they came to be writers, how their particular experience has informed what they do, what they want to do, how they push themselves to go beyond the boundaries of what they know, how, you know, navigating the field as black writers. But I don't know. I found them, a lot of their inspiration, all so inspiring.
Yeah. You're the first person to recommend a podcast, I feel like. Maybe the second. And I feel like that's good, though, because y'all listening, you love podcasts. So go check out this. You said long form.
It's called long form, long which form. Is not
that's perfect.
Black art itself.
But these
but
three
y'all
podcasts.
Can skip to the black people. But you can skip
to the you can spread the love. Yeah. No, that's great. I'm going to go listen to them. That sounds fascinating. The second question, to wrap it all up, is if you could give a shout out to a fellow black artist, who would it be?
I think it would, not to repeat myself, but maybe it would be Jocelyn.
I
just adore her, and I find her so inspiring. She's also one of those people, so personality-wise, she just makes me feel happy. She makes me start laughing. Yeah. All I want, I see her, and I just like want to drink and gossip for like 9 hours. But also, I feel like she's been a real model for me about sort of staying the course. And, you know, I at the beginning of this, I was like, it's just so easy to get bumbled around. You're like, should I do this? These people asked me to do this. And, you know, you can get used up and tired really quick. And she's been really good about reminding me, like, know your worth. You don't owe anybody anything. And write your plays. You know, do your work. And I feel like that voice is one that's a little underdeveloped in me. That muscle, it doesn't get a lot of work. And she's so supportive. And her work is so good. And she's so, I don't know, thorough and just, you know, does so much stuff. And I don't know, it's just, you know, when you find people who you're like, oh, they're doing it right. And, you know, I don't want to take away, I know, you know, life is hard, life is complicated. I know she has, you know, I don't want to just make it seem like her life is perfect.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No, I know, you know, but I think that there are those artists out there who I'm like, what do they do? Mm-hmm. You know, what's their little map and how have they managed to sort of keep their head above water and stay good humored and stay generous and sort of have a generosity of spirit that feels
Generosity of spirit. Yeah. See the word work you doing over here. She does have this like inner light that I feel like radiates, you know, like you and her both have that in common. So
Shout out to Jocelyn. She's the best. Shout out to Jocelyn. She's really wonderful.
She's a podcast alum as you are now too, officially. We gotta have like we've been trying to plan a cookout, so we will
really?
Have a cookout.
Okay.
Yeah, in the warmer months. But thank you so much for being here today.
Alicia, thank you so much for having me. Edit out everything that sounds stupid. Listeners know that I told her to do that. So if I sound really smart, it's just because she's been good and was like snip, snip, snip.
You had so many great things to say. And listeners, if you do and you should want to go see Paris, it's at Atlantic Theater Stage 2. You can get tickets at atlantictheater.org. And y'all can find Paris on the homepage. And if people want to follow your journey, where can they find you on social media?
I am on Instagram. I'm trying to get better.
All right.
I'm doing my stories. I haven't put a post up since August. But I know. Better. I gotta get better.
We'll make it work. Yeah.
But do I say my handle?
Yeah.
Is that what I do? Okay.
Yeah.
It's Ebony Bebony.
Cute.
EBONI. Bebony.
And you guys will see her on the Instagram post, so you can follow her there. And we did a Mighty Fine Boomerang earlier. So
my first one.
Hey. I'm so excited to see how the rest of the run goes.
Me too. I'm really excited. I'm so glad to have been here. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Until next time, y'all.